seeking greatness. I think I'm finally coming to terms with the reality that children, even very young children, show more logic and sense than many grown-ups do. Case in point is a little story about a young girl named Mickey, whose parents got a very disturbing letter from her teacher at school. The letter said in part, "Mickey is an excellent student, but when we have art and coloring projects, she draws everything in dark blue. Sky, grass, flowers, people, houses, kittens, cars, buildings, sun, moon, trees, all in dark blue." This is unusual for a second grader. Can you think of any explanation? If she's having some sort of emotional problem, we need to get to the bottom of it. Well, that night, the very worried parents sat down with young Mickey and asked her why all her pictures from school were rendered in dark blue. "Why is that a special color to you?" they asked. "Well," she began, "I wasn't going to tell you, but see, about 2 weeks ago I lost my box of crayons. And the only one left was a dark blue one I found in the front compartment of my book sack." Mickey's reasoning was sound, wasn't it? And it was completely logical. How many times have we read too much into a child's actions or comments? The reason is we think that with age and experience, we know better. But do we? There's a danger in today's gospel lesson of reading this little incident in the life of Jesus and his disciples and concluding that Jesus was just being kind of quaint and subtle, but he was anything but. This passage marks a very significant moment in the gospel record. If you'll remember, Jesus had just come down from the Mount of Transfiguration. He had healed the demon-possessed boy when they got down into the valley. And that healing just stunned everybody, disciples included, because as we learn later, the disciples who had been left behind instead of going up the mountain were unable to cast out that demon. And Jesus states that only with prayer can such an exorcism happen. It was a very exciting time, and Jesus' popularity was growing exponentially. Notice in verse 30 what happens. It reads that Jesus and his disciples went away from there and passed through Galilee, but Jesus did not want the crowds to know his travel plans. Why? Why the secrecy? Well, it seems, according to Mark, that Jesus wanted to take some private time with his disciples to teach them critical matters of the faith and also to tell them what was to come for Jesus personally. In particular, Jesus begins to talk about his impending betrayal, death, and resurrection. And Mark is quite blunt in the disciples' reaction, isn't he? They don't get it. They do not understand the significance or the necessity of what Jesus is telling them. Furthermore, they are embarrassed and therefore afraid to ask Jesus to explain further, to open it up a little bit. I think we can understand their confusion. Consider, if you will, the disciples had just seen Jesus do some amazing things, and now what does Jesus talk about? He talks about betrayal and death and resurrection. Now, this passage today is actually part of a larger section of Mark. It begins in verse 22 of chapter 8 and goes to 10:52, in which there's actually a threefold pattern emerging. Three separate occasions. Three separate times Jesus predicts his suffering and death. Three times the disciples don't get it. And three times Jesus has to give them further teaching. Jesus even uses the title Son of Man, which is right out of Daniel 7, verse 13, to indicate to them that he's no ordinary rabbi. He's different. And they still don't get it. Amy Oden, commenting on this passage, even goes so far as to say that disciples were knuckleheads. I think that's a bit harsh. But nonetheless, it's accurate. What the disciples were most afraid of unpacking was the very heart of the incarnation. How is it that the Son of Man, or Son of God, is to suffer and die, they wondered. And Jesus lays it out for them how he is significantly different from other prophets, different from other rabbis, any before and any since. And the question in front of the disciples has been a perplexing one throughout the history of the church. The idea of a suffering Messiah so upset the early Christians that some of them came up with alternative theologies, what we might call heresies, to try and explain away the suffering of Jesus and his death. They didn't try to explain the death and its meaning, they just wanted to get rid of it. There were people who believed in docetism. And that means that they believed that Jesus never really suffered at all, it was some type of an illusion. The Gnostics, who thought they had special knowledge from God, the Greek word gnosis means knowledge, believed that only the human part of Jesus suffered, but, you know, the divine part was left untouched. The Gnostics even wrote their own gospels to try and teach that. The Gospel of Thomas, for example. It was the Gnostic position that was made famous recently in Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code. That's Gnosticism. Gnostics were present so early in the church that it's clear when you read the New Testament that the Apostle Paul and other writers, namely John, tried to counter their heresies. No wonder it is then that 1 Corinthians 1:18, Paul states adamantly, "For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to those who are being saved, it is the power of God." In this chapter of Mark, verses 31 and 32 go right to the heart of who Jesus is and the very nature of God. Why would God demote himself to the point of death on the cross, the disciples wondered. So you gotta wonder, why didn't the disciples just ask Jesus to explain it further? Frankly, they did not want to appear as confused as they really were. It might have been embarrassing that those who were closest to Jesus were just as ignorant about the nature of who Jesus was as the crowds were. Perhaps, as some people are apt to do, they reasoned, well, maybe the other disciples know and I don't, so I'll just keep my ignorance under wraps. I understand this approach. No one wants to feel uninformed. No one likes being confused. No one likes being clueless. You know, all of us have had those moments, those experiences when we're in a group of acquaintances. And they're all talking at length about a subject that we realize we know absolutely little or nothing about. And the feeling of being left out of the conversation is quite painful. So to compensate, what do? We ask questions. Not necessarily for knowledge, but to look knowledgeable. Or we might agree with someone else's opinion when we have no idea if they're correct or not, but it makes us look like we understand what's going on. Maybe that's why a certain U.S. president speaks so often before he thinks right now. Speaks before he clearly understands. In a church fellowship, our hesitancy to ask questions emerges frequently. We erroneously think that we do not have hard questions in our lives. We believe that everyone else has the answers to the hard questions, and somehow God's withheld the answer from me. And so we suffer in silence. Oh boy, how we long to ask questions like, why do good people suffer? Or, why are people so brutal to each other sometimes? Or, why does evil seem to succeed? Or, if God's own son was betrayed and killed, then who among us is truly safe? Why did God set up the world the way he did? So, with these hard questions, we conclude, why ask them? For the same reason the disciples should have asked their questions. For when we avoid the hard questions of life, the questions that we are afraid to ask one another, we begin to focus on trivial matters. Trivial matters about, like, arguing over who is the greatest. There's a direct line in this passage from verse 32 to 34. When the disciples avoid asking the hard questions about Jesus' betrayal, death, and resurrection, they immediately begin to argue over who among them is right, the best, the most important. It's incredible. Jesus is talking to them about how he's working his way down in status in this world, and the disciples, what are they arguing about? How to increase their status in this world. And they just show completely how ignorant they are of who Jesus is, what he represents, and how often we're apt to do the same thing. Out of our pain of not understanding what's going on in our lives, the temptation is to focus on the wrong things. If I cannot make my relationships function in a healthy way, or I cannot cope with facing my own mortality, or I wonder if there really is a heaven, if I struggle to see my value in my work, or if I just want to climb to the highest point in Norfolk County and scream out why, if I cannot bring myself to do that, what am I going to do? I'll lash out at others. I will argue over things that are tangible and controllable. Such is the true story. This is a true story. It's from August 1999 in Landover, Maryland. It ended up in the newspaper. And the paper article reads in part, 100 years of Christian fellowship, unity, and community outreach ended last Tuesday in an act of congregational discord. Holy Creek Baptist Church was split into multiple factions. The source of dissension, I cannot believe this. I thought they were kidding. The source of dissension is the position of the piano bench, which still sits behind their 1923 Steinway piano, which is to the left of their pulpit. Position of the piano bench. Members and friends of Holy Creek Baptist say that that old bench has been a source of hostility for decades. That their people should have seen it coming. At present, Holy Creek congregation will be having 4 services every Sunday. There's been an agreement mediated by an outside pastor so that each faction can have their own separate service with their own separate pastor. Since the head pastor's not speaking to the associate pastors, each will have their own service, which will be attended by each faction's members. The services are spaced far enough apart that no two groups will ever come into contact with each other. And an outside party will be moving the piano bench to the different locations and appropriate positions between services to please all sides and avoid any further contact or conflict that could result in violence. Do you think they've been asking the hard questions of each other? I wonder how this scriptural passage would have been different if the disciples had simply asked the questions. How, in fact, would our lives be different if we, even through anger and a lot of tears, sat with each other and asked the hard questions of life? Questions with no easy or maybe no answers at all. What would our relationships in this fellowship look like if we all encouraged each other and lovingly welcomed the hard questions? In all honesty, we may not come to some satisfying answers, but I am certain there's some real healing in simply getting the tough stuff out there. What if instead of after the service talking about the weather or the sports, we took time to really listen to each other's souls, to honestly explore the question of, how are you today? Have we the courage to answer honestly the hard questions with, I just don't know, but I feel your pain, and I'll pray with you. Now here's the other thing to consider from this little passage. Notice that in reaction to the disciples' argument about who was the greatest, Jesus calls over a little child. Did you notice that? He did not explode in anger. He did not argue with them. He simply placed the child in the midst of them. Some people would think that he put the child on his knee. I don't know. And he says, whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me. We love this moment because it reveals Jesus' tenderness, doesn't it? But is there something else going on here? Consider what it means to welcome a child. I mean, really welcome a child. Not just tolerate a child because he or she's parents brought them along. This is no idle question for God's people. And it is directly tied to asking the hard questions of life. Consider how children are thought of in our society, really. Oh, we claim to love them, but often children are seen as burdens and nuisances. How else do you explain articles in the newspaper every once in a while about some parent leaving their toddler or even their babies in cars so they can go into the casino or the mall or the local tavern? How else do you explain the old adage that was drilled into me as a child that children should be seen but not heard? How often has a little one come up to us and tugged on our pant leg or the hem of our dress? And we've said, not now. I get it. Children are impetuous. They lack social graces sometimes. They say ridiculous things sometimes. But Jesus said, unless we welcome them, we do not welcome him. Why is that? Well, because you know what? We too are impetuous. We too can be rude. We too say ridiculous things from time to time. We have what some call foot and mouth disease. And what, pray tell, is the posture in welcoming a child? Is it not to bend down or to kneel down to somehow get to their level? Welcoming a child is an act of humility. Therefore, we recognize and approach God in Christ as a child. That is, with humility, but also with one other critical factor. We approach God with honesty. You and I know that kids are apt to say anything. Case in point, true story, just a few weeks ago, I had the privilege of attending someone's 75th birthday celebration. It was a dinner. We had just enjoyed a wonderful meal at one of the local restaurants here in town, and the grandchildren at the birthday celebration were enjoying the after-dinner festivities of running around and playing with each other and giggling and laughing and interacting sporadically with the adults who were still sitting at the table and having conversation. Suddenly, one of the grandchildren, the oldest one, came up to me and looked me right in the eye and bluntly asked the question that had been on her mind, obviously, throughout the entire dinner. Looking me right in the eye, she blurted out, "Why are you here?" Now, before I could answer, her grandparent responded, her grandfather actually, the birthday boy, responded and said, "Because we felt sorry for him." The little child that Jesus took upon his lap or into their midst was really not important in the grand scheme of thing in Jesus' society. You remember, we're going to see this in just a couple of chapters after, the mothers of Salem brought their children to be blessed by Jesus, and the disciples tried to shoo them away. I bet the children that day didn't have a clue why their mothers wanted them to meet Jesus. I bet they didn't really know. Nor did that little one in our passage today know why Jesus picked him or her out and put them in the midst of all these grown men. So they too might have asked the hard question, why am I here? That's one of the big questions, isn't it? Why are we here? A question that can really only be asked out of humility, in the posture of a child who's tugging on a pant leg or a skirt hem. You know, there's something really special in being invited into a child's world and into their thinking. To see things as they see them. To take pleasure in the simplest of things. To embrace the privilege of being embraced into their imagination. Such as my own daughter, who as a little girl took great pleasure in sitting her dad down in a chair and then dolling him up with necklaces and tiaras and hair clips and scarves. It was great fun. In fact, Laura probably has a picture around somewhere of me and my finery. You know, I can easily picture Jesus enjoying the laughter and the play of children. I do not think it's a stretch to think that he may have even joined in their games from time to time. After all, we're all his children. He knit them together. He knit us together in our mother's wombs, according to Psalm 139. Jesus takes joy in us. He expresses compassion and grace into our struggles. Our destiny is not about greatness. It's not about finding all the answers in the world. In fact, it is much simpler than that. The very famous Swiss-German theologian Karl Barth was delivering one of the very last lectures of his life at the University of Chicago Divinity School. And at the very end of the lecture, the president of the seminary told the audience that Dr. Barth was not feeling very well, and he was very tired. And although Dr. Barth would like to answer questions, he thought that the strain on the poor doctor would be too great. So he said to Dr. Barth, "Therefore, I'll ask just one question on behalf of everyone here." He turned to Dr. Barth and he asked this: "Of all the theological insights you've ever had, which do you consider to be the greatest of all?" It was a remarkable question to ask a man who had written literally tens of thousands of pages of some of the most sophisticated theology that had ever been put down on paper. And students in the audience that day grabbed their pens and their papers, and they sat with rapt attention, ready to write. They didn't want to miss this moment, that premier insight from the greatest theologian who had ever lived. Karl Barth closed his eyes and he thought for a moment. And then he smiled. He opened his eyes and he said to the young seminarians, "The greatest theological insight I have ever had is this. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." These are words that even the most childlike among us can fully understand.